This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Thank you. And no Ian Ozan, no Ian McNulty today because he had a prior commitment. But we're going to talk to Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission, go over some of the strides New Orleans made in combating crime in 2025 and what Mayor-elect Moreno should keep doing and maybe change. And with that, we welcome in our friend Rafael Goyeneche. Happy New Year, Rafael. It's been a while. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, same to you. Happy New Year to you and your audience.
Let's talk about 2025. It started terribly, obviously, with the New Year's attack, and I'm, you know, I hate to say this because it sounds terrible to take that away, but statistically, and that doesn't change the harm, the damage, the lives that were affected, the lives that were lost. I understand all that, the pain and the grieving, but just statistically, to take that away, what does that say about, or what do the numbers say about crime in New Orleans in 2025?
So overall, with the exception of homicides, every category of crime, property and violence, are down in 25 versus 24. Homicides are just about flat. As of today, taking a look at last year, we had one fewer homicide in 25 than we had in 24.
That takes into account
the
14.
Pointed out,
oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, no, that includes the 14.
Okay.
So, it, you know, the terror attack absolutely adversely impacted our homicide rate. And, you know, it's not just about, you know, trying to beat last year's numbers. I mean, we're talking about 14 lives that were lost in one event. Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't happen in any community. So when that happens in New Orleans, it is going to skew statistically the numbers. So, you know, thank God that, you know, that has been a one-time event. I think that there are a lot of lessons that were learned from January the 1st of 2025. And I think you're seeing, you know, different levels of security throughout the city for major events because of what happened on January the 1st of 2025.
Why?
So,
no, go ahead, finish.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. No. I want to hear you.
Well,
I'm here every day, Rafael.
I'm going to say that, you know, law enforcement has to learn and constantly modify their strategies based on trends that they're seeing. One of the things that wasn't factored into, you know, our strategies was a terrorist attack. So now that that has happened, I think, you know, some of the vulnerabilities have been reassessed. And I think the police department and their partners in state and federal law enforcement have worked with the city of New Orleans to reduce the potential for that occurring in the future.
Murder, homicides, as it relates to national numbers, I guess New Orleans is along with that. The homicides are down. And one thing, and I know you study this, that I can't understand is why. Does it mean we're making, is it cyclical? Does it mean that we're making inroads into whatever it is that are the roots of crime that lead to violent crime? Or is it just, do things like this happen? Can you go back in history and look at cycles where it's like, yeah, well, it was down for that period, but then it came back up again?
So, you know, I'm not a criminologist.
Right.
I'm looking at the numbers and to see the numbers of where they were in 20 and 2021 and 2022, mm-hmm. you're not going to statistically change the social culture over a short period of time, in my opinion.
Okay.
So what we've experienced in this city is a dramatic reduction in violent crime. And as violent crime has gone down, we're seeing now that the police department, despite their manpower crisis, is able to devote more time to property offenses. And we're seeing property crime go down. So I believe that the reductions are primarily attributable to the police department leaning into technology, establishing a closer working relationship and trust between the public. And I think that one of the things that's often overlooked in crime reductions is the district attorney's office's ability to handle the increased arrests that are made by the police department. And what we're seeing in New Orleans is the New Orleans district attorney's office, I think, has been doing a better job of imposing consequences on violent and repeat offenders over the past 2 years. So the police department is heavily leaning into prioritizing not just the arrest, but the successful prosecution of violent and repeat offenders. And the police department can't do that without a strong working relationship with the public and with the district attorney's office. I believe that those are the primary reasons that violent crime and all categories of crime are down in the city of New Orleans over the last couple of years.
Does that speak to and talk about, if you will, how it is a relatively small amount of people that are causing most of the problems?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, you have studies going back into the 1970s that show, you know, that quantify and show that a small percentage of the offenders are responsible for a disproportionate amount of crime in the community. So when you take a look at the inmate population, and we issue reports on that on a weekly basis, so we're seeing that the inmate population is now about, and I'm relying on my memory right now because I'm away from the office today, about 1,250 or so inmates, but almost two-thirds of those inmates are in there for felony crimes of violence or felony weapons offenses. Meaning that those offenders are off the streets, which means that there is less violence, and many of those violent offenders were also engaging in other forms of crime. So as those 1,250 inmates were taken off the streets, the city is safer. So, you know, there's a cause and effect between the public trusting the police department, providing the police department with the information that they need to conduct investigations, make arrests, and then the district attorney's office, I think, is a critical component in maintaining crime reductions because there has to be consequences imposed on the people that are being arrested. The police department can't do that merely by arrest. It has to be a joint effort by the, including the district attorney's office, to be able to remove those offenders and impose consequences through the criminal justice system.
It sounds to me as though going back to the dark days of the DA fighting with the police department and the public not trusting the police department, that we have done a 180 from that, or at least maybe not 180, but gotten a long way from that. And it was a pretty simple solution in theory, maybe not that easy to pull off, but you get people to testify, you get the police to make strong cases, you get the DA to prosecute those cases, push for harder sentences, and you keep the bad guys locked away in jail. That's what we're saying, right? Pretty much?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's that simple and all that. But, you know, it's simply said.
Simply said,
but
yes.
When you take a look at where we were and where we are today, it's night and day, you know, and over a relatively short period of time. So this turnaround is, I think, you know, a prime example of, if it were just enough to say that all we needed was to arrest the offenders, we wouldn't need a prosecutor's office. Mm-hmm. Of course you need a prosecutor's office. And I think part of the problem of a couple of years ago in 20 and 21 and into 22, when crime was spiking, there weren't being consequences imposed on the people that were being arrested. We've seen that change beginning in the latter part of 22 into 23 through 24 and now in 25. And, you know, I'm hoping and I have every reason to believe that, you know, the police department and the district attorney's office are going to get even better in imposing consequences on the people that are being arrested. Because one of the things I've also observed, Tommy, is that police department is relying heavily on technology to identify and arrest the individual. So keep in mind that the standard to arrest is probable cause. The standard that a prosecutor applies to begin a prosecution is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So when you have video evidence, when you have forensic evidence, when you have ballistic evidence, that is the type of evidence that prosecutors are looking for to meet the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. And those investigations that are being based on forensics and digital and video evidence is, I think, the reason that prosecutors are being more successful, because the stronger the evidence, the more likely the district attorney's office can be successful in prosecuting those offenders.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up here. We come back. I want to talk about the technology that they're leaning into. I also want to talk about another stool in this, which is the criminal court system and the judges, et cetera. We're talking to Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission, looking over the strides New Orleans made in combating crime in 2025, not just violent, but you heard Rafael say also now turning attention toward property crimes. And then we'll look ahead to 2026. If you got any questions, comments, text them in the 504-260-1870. That is the Oakland Heart Jeweler Talk and text line. I'll pass them along when we come back here on WWL. 924, talking to Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission, going over what happened with crime in New Orleans in 2025 and looking ahead to 2026. So, Rafael, you know, there's an old saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. However, stuff can always be improved, right? So somebody texted in and said, better leadership in the police department may have lent to some of the success of lower crime rates as well. Kudos to the new chief. But let's talk about number of officers. Let's talk about overtime and improving the strides that they've already made, and not just when it comes to violent crime, but when it comes to property crime, et cetera. Does the MCC have any thoughts on the use of overtime or the right number of officers or what should be done moving ahead to 2026?
All right. So everybody understands that the police department is understaffed. And that means that we're down about 300 officers from where we were in January of 2020. So the only way to compensate for that is to use overtime.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
So that has historically been a part of the police department's strategy in combating crime. Even when there were 1,200 to 1,500 officers, there was always going to be overtime. Mm-hmm. Why is there overtime? Well, when you have special events, and New Orleans is essentially a special events city, you know, the officers that are normally deployed for the special events require that officers work overtime. So that has historically been a part of the police department's budget, and it becomes even more important when there are staffing deficiencies. So for the foreseeable future, you know, the police department is not going to be able to eliminate overtime. We just got finished with, you know, a successful New Year's celebration, and we're immediately embarking on Mardi Gras, which is 2 weeks worth of overtime that the police department is going to be working. So I think that, you know, we as a city recognize that 900 officers are not enough. The police department is doing everything in their power to recruit officers, and we're seeing a little progress made in the last half of last year, but it's going to take a couple of years at best to rebuild those numbers. And the way that we compensate for that is A, overtime, and B, technology. And that's one of the things that I've really noticed in 2025, the police department leaning into technology as a force multiplier. So what we're seeing right now is a drone program that's being introduced in the French Quarter. Mm-hmm. So the drones are essentially being used as the first responder. When a call for service comes in the French Quarter, you've got a pilot program down there where a drone will be deployed, and they can be at the scene in less than a minute in the French Quarter, and they're producing digital quality video back to the drone operator to police officers to more quickly arrive at the scene of a reported incident and be able to provide the police with the information that they need to more quickly identify who the perpetrator is.
To know what the hell went on before they got there, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a safety thing for the public. It's a safety thing for police officers so that they know what they're getting to. And because of the crowds down there, police officers can't get there as quickly as a drone can. So every minute that goes by, every second that goes by, that, you know, the police are attempting to respond to, if that drone can get there, that can immediately provide data and information to the police that allow them to more quickly identify, you know, who is responsible for the offense, the type of offense, and the threat that it poses to public safety, and be able to use their assets more strategically.
Somebody wanted to know about violent crime, murders as opposed to shootings, and that goes to medical assistance being rendered, and what could have been a murder turns into an assault instead, or whatever the charge would be. Any data on that, Raphael?
All right. So we have fatal and non-fatal shooting statistics. Mm-hmm. So virtually every non-fatal shooting had the potential to be a fatal shooting.
Right.
Most of the non-fatal shootings, the intention was to kill somebody. And, you know, by the grace of God, and because of the poor marksmanship of the offender, and because of medical science and the, you know, first responders that get there that can provide life-saving, care, and the fact that we're a level one trauma center at LSU Medical Center, we're seeing fewer non-fatal shootings evolve into potential homicides. So, you know, it is no one single cause and effect. It is, you know, medical science, it's technology, it's the police department, and it's the district attorney's office and the criminal justice system that collectively are working together to reduce crime throughout the city.
Do the courts have a hand in this? Have they stepped up?
Of course, yeah. Yeah, they have. So last spring, we issued a report. And, you know, we were talking about, the crime in the city. One of the things that the Crime Commission does is we do more than just report the calls for service or track the numbers of arrests. We track the outcomes of all of those. And we've issued reports on the courts going back over 20 years. And when we released that report in the spring, there are 12 sections, felony sections of a court in criminal district court. And only one of the 12 sections was an outlier with respect to the size of the docket. And one judge, Judge Daryl Durbiny, was identified. He presided over Section J of Criminal District Court. His docket was double the size of the other 11 judges on the court. So he had over 500 open cases. And by the time we issued that report, his docket was approaching 550 to 600 cases. The Supreme Court stepped in. Judge Durbiny took medical leave and ultimately retired from the bench in August. The Supreme Court appointed an ad hoc to preside over his section of court. And since that ad hoc has been appointed, Judge Durbiny's docket was reduced by 50%. So as that docket is being reduced, we're seeing the pretrial inmate population go down because the backlog of cases in that section of court has reduced, and that served as motivation for the court to collectively do a more effective and efficient job in moving cases through the system. I send my staff to court on a regular basis, and judges throughout the court are prompting prosecutors and defense counsel to move their cases and be prepared for trial and be prepared for hearings. And we're seeing the inmate population go down because the cases that are moving through the court are moving through court more effectively and efficiently. And that's, you know, again, a product of the district attorney's office, the public defender's office, and the police department, I think, being prepared and ready. And the judges are basically the referees moving the game along and the process along.
Does the National Guard have a role in any of this moving forward, Rafael?
So they're a force multiplier. They're not going to arrest anybody. They're not going to conduct an investigation. They're not going to respond to a 911 call. They're going to do the work that required police officers, that diverted the police department from the ability to respond more timely to a 911 call, to have more time to devote to an investigation that will result in an arrest. So the way we've seen the National Guard used here is the way that we've seen them used here for decades. They come in for special events. Usually what we see the National Guard historically is after a storm. And what they do is they help and assist the police department. Over New Year's and after the terror attack, we saw the National Guard here, and they were basically manning the barricades along the perimeter of the French Quarter. They were a visual deterrent. They weren't making arrests. They weren't investigating, and they weren't responding to calls for service. But by them doing that, that allowed the police department and the state police to be able to respond to calls for service more quickly because they weren't having to check people in and out through the barricades. That was something that could be delegated to the National Guard. So I think that the National Guard has historically had a positive impact on crime in this city when they are here. And it's not because of them being police officers, it's freeing up some of the tasks that police officers have to do with an understaffed police department, allowing the police department to be more effective in driving down the crime rate by being able to respond, investigate, and arrest offenders.
When it comes to the sheriff and getting the prisoners to court on time, and one of the bigger stories of 2025 was the mass escape, Are you confident that things have kind of, I hate to say calmed down over there, but things are more under control over there and the situation is getting better? I know we got a new sheriff going in.
Right, but the new sheriff doesn't take office until the beginning of May.
Oh, I thought it was in January.
You know,
Okay.
No, that's another five. We got another 5 months.
I got you.
That's kind of a, you know, a quirky thing in the law. So even though the public made their choice back in November, we're not going to see a changing of the guards until May.
Well, you taught me something. I thought it was in I thought all city offices were in January. Anyway, go ahead, please.
No. So New Orleans is the only jurisdiction in which the sheriff's office is exclusively a corrections, position. So most sheriffs throughout the state of Louisiana are the first responders. They conduct investigations. They make arrests. The Orleans Parish Sheriff's Office, their role is to manage the inmate population. They don't arrest them. They don't decide whether those offenders are going to be prosecuted. It's the district attorney's office. They don't set bail. That's the responsibility of the judges. The sheriff is basically the custodian of everybody that is submitted for booking into that facility. And that's a concentration.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
And of the most violent offenders in the state of Louisiana, I believe that Orleans Parish Jail is the toughest correctional facility in the state of Louisiana to manage. Yeah. Much more challenging, in my opinion, than Angola, because in Angola you have individuals that have been there for decades, and any time a new inmate is introduced to Angola, they are introduced to the culture of that facility by the inmates that have been there for decades. In Orleans Parish, you're looking at 200-plus pretrial individuals that are being held on murder charges. None of them have been adjudicated. And those are violent offenders. And when you have them in a pretrial facility like the jail, but many of those offenders are adversaries of some of the other inmates. So it makes it extremely difficult to manage that facility when you have that concentration of violent offenders. Many of those offenders, if they encounter someone on the streets that's in that jail, that's a crime. Mm-hmm. And now the sheriff is responsible for maintaining the control of sworn enemies in the same correctional facility. On top of that, the guards that are working in the facility come from the same neighborhoods as many of the offenders and are known by the offenders, which makes the introduction of contraband into the jail even more of a challenge in New Orleans than in Angola, because the guards come from that general area and the inmates are coming from other parts of the state. In the local jail, we're looking at the inmates and the guards. In many instances, they went to school together. Their families know each other. So it makes it more difficult, more challenging for the sheriff's office to maintain security in a facility like that.
Do you have any confidence that things have changed from the Great Escape and that she does have a better handle on things now? The staff does?
Yeah, I believe there is. My great concern is the maintenance that has been neglected, I think, for too long. So just like the police department, you don't have enough deputies. And that means that if you don't have enough deputies, you better make sure that the facility's security measures are operational and being maintained. And one of the things that we learned after that Great Escape was that there were over 1,000 open maintenance work orders in process. That is alarming, that there would be 1,000 open work orders to repair the jail, and that explains why that jailbreak occurred, because the break didn't happen until the last guard that was there decided to take a lunch break. Mm-hmm. And what we found out was the inmates were able to open their own cells and notice that the guard was gone from the control booth, and that's when the escape occurred. So the jail cells were supposed to be locked. They weren't locked. They weren't being repaired, and that was just on one pod. And you're looking at over 1,000 work orders that were in the process of being repaired, and they weren't being repaired. And that, I think, the failure of the technology coupled with the lack of staffing resulted in that mass escape.
Thank you, Raphael. Never enough time. We'll talk to you again, I'm sure, in 2026. Have a great new year, my friend.
Same to you.
Take care. Bye-bye. You bet. Raphael Goyeneche, President, Metropolitan Crime Commission. We're going to end on a lighter note. We're going to talk about Tulane having over 8 million fish, rather. 8 million and one. They just added another one. In an old World War II bunker in Belchase. We'll talk about it when we come back on WWL. Here's traffic first, though. All right, 949. If you had told me when I moved to Belchase in 1993 that there were over 8 million preserved species of fish, I would have said, get out of here. But Brian Sidlauskas, did I get that right, Brian?
Mm-hmm.
Sidlauskas joins us now, director of the Tulane University Biodiversity Research Institute and a current curator of the Royal D. Sutkus Fish Collection is here. And is that true?
It is absolutely true. There
get out of here.
8 million preserved fishes in Belchase.
Tell me how this whole thing came to be. I think it's a fascinating story.
Well, I appreciate that. This is a library of biodiversity, and it is a historical record of the diversity of fishes that exists throughout the southeastern portion of the United States and throughout the Gulf. And it's part of a network of such collections that exist around the world. We happen to be the biggest one in the world by the measure of the number of specimens that we have on the shelf.
When it comes to, you know, because a lot of people, obviously, you see the boats go down Belchase Highway, as do I. What are some of the things that you have there, some species that either have not been seen in a long time or come from the depths where fishermen have never seen them and would be hard-pressed to believe that they actually came out of the Gulf of Mexico?
Absolutely. So our most famous and perhaps most important specimen is a species of pocket shark. It's a very tiny shark collected in the deep waters of the Gulf. And it's the only specimen of that species that exists on the planet. Everything that we know about that species is related to one specimen that we have stored out there in Belgium.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So it is one extinct, specimen. Or do you know?
It's probably not extinct. It was collected in just in the last decade. It's just very rare. It's a tiny shark that lives in the deep sea, and we know very little about it.
Tell me about the deep sea things that you guys have there, because I was reading a newspaper story from Alex Lubin at NOLA.com, and some of these things from way, 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 way beneath the surface really are weird, huh?
Yeah, they are weird, and they're also wonderful. The deep sea is an incredible environment, and fishes can survive any place on the planet where there's water. These new specimens that are coming in are a donation from some of our collaborators at the Deep End Consortium, which is run out of Nova Southeastern in Florida, mm-hmm. by one of my colleagues, Tracy Sutton, and some others. And those specimens are incredibly well-preserved records of specimens that they've collected as part of their surveys about how climate change is affecting the Gulf. And after they're done with their initial studies, they want a place to put those specimens so that other researchers can have access to them. And so they've donated them to the Tulane University Biodiversity Research Institute and the Sutkus Collection as a place to hold them in perpetuity. Now, if you want to know about the biology of the species, they're just amazing. Of course, you know, the deep sea is a place that fishes light up, and so there's all kinds of bioluminescence, and fishes use that to attract other fishes to be their meals, but they also do it in order to identify potential mates, and there are even some that use it for hunting. And there's all sorts of other wonderful things. But the deep sea fish are amazing, and they just donated several hundred specimens of about 70 species, several of which were new to the collection.
Is any of this open to the public or not?
The collection is open by appointment, so it's not really a museum. We're set up as a research institute, but if there are researchers that wish to come and come in to use the specimens, we certainly make that happen. We also occasionally do things like school tours, but they need to be arranged in advance.
What is it that most, I guess, intrigues you about everything that's in there, Brian?
Oh, my goodness. I could talk to you for days about that. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's the diversity of fishes. They're just absolutely astonishing. If you add up together all of the other vertebrates on the planet, all the mammals, all the birds, all the reptiles, all of those together equal the fishes. There's more than 36,000 living species of fishes that we know about, many extinct, many not described. And the collections like these help us learn about them. We can learn where they exist on the planet, how they differ from each other. We can look back in time and see how they've changed over time. We can even do things like look at microplastics in their bodies or their parasites, or all sorts of wonderful science with this library and with 8 million specimens and several million more on the way. We can do science at a scope with these that's not possible in smaller collections. But I love the diversity of fishes.
8 million specimens. Do you have any speckled trout?
We definitely get speckled trout.
You're supposed to say no, and I was just say, there you go, 8 million one. what I did when I asked you seriously, though, is when it comes to the guy that put all of this together, tell me about him, Royal Sutkus. He was an interesting man, wasn't he?
He was absolutely interesting, and it's a complete honor to occupy his tenure life. He was famous for being one of the most prolific collectors that ever existed for fishes and for other animals as well. He was active from about 1950 through about 2000, a little bit after that, but he started to age thereafter. And he personally had a hand in collecting more than 5 million of the specimens that are in the collection. And no one collects like that, certainly not today. And even in his day, he was a legend for just spending almost all of his time out in the field understanding the natural history of the southeastern U.S. No one knew the fishes better than he did, or even just the natural environment. He went everywhere. And he went back to some places over and over again in order to maintain a record of what existed in, for example, the Pearl River, one of his favorite places to go. And he went there for decades. And that means that we have a record of what existed, for example, before and after the Clean Water Act was passed. And so we can begin to track changes in diversity or the shape of the animals or which ones were present, their parasites, all of those things over time.
Is there a website? I'm sorry, we're just about out of time. Is there a website that people can go to find out more about this?
Certainly. It's tubri.org, T-U-B-R-I.org.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. Happy New Year to you, and thanks for taking the time with us.
Happy New Year to you
Very
as well.
Interesting. You bet. Brian Sidlauskas, director of the Tulane University Biodiversity Research Center and a current curator at the Royal D. Sutkus Fish Collection. Who knew? 9:56, back in a flash, WWL.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.